Jabalia Dome is also known as the Gabri Dome, and it's located in Kerman. And the structure is octagonal. The dome has been constructed of brick, though the building is of stone and gypsum, and its architectural effects have been inspired from the Sasanid period. Today, this place is being used as the Stone Museum of Kerman, but many historians believe that it is used to be a fire temple or a burial site belonging to the Zoroastrians of Kerman. A fire temple or Ateshkere in Zoroastrianism is the place of worship for Zoroastrians. Zoroastrians respect fire in any form. In the Zoroastrian religion, fire together with clean water are agents of ritual purity. Zoroastrians are the oldest and the largest religious minority in Kerman. Zoroastrian Anthropology Museum of Kerman gives you a glimpse of rituals, traditions, and the lifestyle of Zoroastrians in this region. Different types of fire braziers and lanterns, antique copper pots and containers, very old handwritten manuscripts, and old photos of the Zoroastrian societies of Kerman and Rafsanjan are among the items that are being displayed at this museum. I think I've told you enough about Kerman and its surroundings. It's time to pack your stuff and get ready for a trip to this beautiful land. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.
The heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope, you guide us with your light. Blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
Salam and welcome, friends, near and far. This is Iran Radio coming to you from Tehran, and I'll be your guide through a rich tapestry of sound stories of faith, voices of thought, and the pulse of a world in motion. Keep listening, because what's ahead is worth your time. Our next program is Leader's Speech. Listen to English translations of selected segments and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on various important occasions. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. Next up, we have Africa Today. For now, please stay with us for Leader's Speech.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history. 2016. Imam Khamenei. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam transformed humility into dignity and savagery into brotherhood. He turned fanaticism into tolerance and reasoning. He transformed a state of ignorance into knowledge. He built a strong and logical foundation on the basis of which Muslims could reach the peaks of global civilizations for centuries and could rise to new heights which were unprecedented in human history. His rule did not last any more than 10 years. You just see what proportion of a nation's lifespan could those 13 years and the following 10 years constitute. It is like a moment which passes very quickly. During such a short time, a great movement was started which could well be said to have divided human history into two eras, the pre-Islamic era and the post-Islamic era. The Holy Prophet ﷺ pushed humanity forwards, strengthened the basis of morality, and left unforgettable lessons for all humans. You should consider the greatness of Mab'ath from such a perspective. There were, of course, a number of interrelated factors which led to this success. But this success was mainly due to the Prophet being full of spirituality, purity, loyalty, and relying completely on God. This was a major and decisive factor in his success. Prior to his prophethood, the Holy Prophet ﷺ was the most knowledgeable and the wisest of the people of Mecca. He was the most generous, respectable, and decent person in the era where he lived. Righteousness win, one must preserve on the path of righteousness. Among those people, this prominent person enjoyed the blessing of God and the responsibility was put on his shoulders. This was because God had put him to the test before. God knew his servant and knew who he was assigning this responsibility to. The Holy Prophet ﷺ stood firm. His resistance and his perseverance that was accompanied by a deep knowledge of the goal he was pursuing and the path that he was treading supported all the achievements of the Holy Prophet ﷺ and led to the success of this great movement. One who is right always wins, but there are some prerequisites. In order for the right to win, one must defend it. To help righteousness win, one must persevere on the path of righteousness.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Who could believe fish falling from the sky, or frogs for that matter? These events sound more like scenes from a science fiction movie than actual news. Even if we weren't living in an age of fake news, accepting such stories would still be difficult. Yet, some seemingly impossible phenomena are real. Rainfalls of fish and frogs do occasionally occur in certain parts of the world. The cause of this strange phenomenon is rare storms. Storms powerful enough to lift aquatic creatures from the sea into the sky and drop them back down over land.
Oh my goodness, look at all of them. This is a pretty good size one.
Forget the men, they're all in quarantine. This New Year's week, it's raining fish.
There's tons of them in my yard and in my driveway.
For a few minutes during a Wednesday afternoon storm, a flurry of them rained down on Texarkana.
So it didn't just hail over here at Walker's One Stop Auto. We've got fish everywhere.
Of course, unbelievable yet real events aren't limited to fish falling from the sky. Something similar happened with the movie Home Alone. Viewers of that film could hardly believe that one of its minor actors would become president of the United States 24 years later. Donald Trump, then the owner of the Plaza Hotel, had agreed to let the crew film there, but only on the condition that he himself appeared in the movie. His rise to power felt like one of those seemingly insignificant moments that later proved pivotal. People stared at Trump's image in disbelief, haunted by a pressing question: how did he manage to become president? Until 2018, there was no clear answer. Some pointed to social shifts in American society, others to the complexities of political strategy. But then, the release of a single news story changed everything.
Breaking news from the New York Times tonight. It is reporting that both the Justice Department and the FBI are investigating the now defunct political data firm Cambridge Analytica. Now, you'll remember the company worked both for the President Trump's election campaign as well as other Republican candidates in 2016.
It was about a major scandal, an electoral scandal that drew many into the unfolding drama.
You know, some people will say to me, but Professor Zuboff, I like those targeted ads. They're so useful. Or I enjoy personalized services. Sometimes people will say, you know, I have nothing to hide, so I don't care what they take. Each one of these statements is a profound misconception of what's really going on.
In 2018, the company Cambridge Analytica found itself at the center of a major scandal. The controversy dated back 2 years before the election, to a time when Facebook had managed to collect data from thousands of users. These data sets were part of users' private information, yet they were secretly handed over to Cambridge Analytica. The data even included details about users' friends, and the company ultimately gained access to information from over 50 million individuals.
We think that the only personal information they have about us is what we've given them. And we think we can exert some control over what we give them. And therefore, we think that our calculation, our trade-off here, is something that is somehow under our control, that we understand.
Analyzing user behavior and interpreting the data could reveal a great deal. Things like personal interests, decision-making patterns, and criteria for choice. This data analysis was put to use by the client, namely Trump's election campaign. They developed a model aimed at influencing undecided voters in key swing states. The next step was targeted advertising in favor of Trump. Analysts, in explaining this strange phenomenon, referred to the science of marketing, a discipline that effectively turned Trump into a product and enabled close monitoring of American voters' choices. They argued that Trump's rise marked the beginning of a new era, the age of surveillance marketing, with hidden and complex dimensions. An era that raises a profound question: are human decisions truly made independently, or are other forces quietly shaping them?
Back in the year 2000, 2001, 2002, back in those days, these data were considered just extra data. They were considered waste material. And people called them things like digital exhaust or data exhaust. Eventually, it was understood that these so-called waste materials harbored these rich predictive data.
In September 2011, the area in front of the Wall Street Stock Exchange was packed with people. Citizens took to the street in protest against economic inequality, capitalist culture, and the influence of large corporations. The protest was a consequence of the 2008 economic crisis, and also a sign of something else, a strange event that had quietly taken place. A new approach in economics emerged, rooted in books from the field of economic theory.
They can predict things like our personality, our emotions, our sexual orientation, our political orientation, a whole range of things that we never, ever intended to disclose.
This approach was related to behavioral economics, which urges that human behavior is not fundamentally based on reason and logic. Some economists who supported this view believe that decision-making was driven by other factors. They spoke of involuntary errors and irrational choices, emphasizing that a large portion of people's decisions are emotionally driven. These irrational behaviors could have negative consequences for society. To prevent such outcomes, an unconventional solution was proposed.
paying attention to irrational choices, subtly shaping them, and guiding people toward better decisions. Within this framework, one could understand the rationale behind the companies involved in election engineering.
The companies like to say, we collect data so that we can improve our service. And that's true. They collect data, and some of it is used to improve the service to you. But even more of it is analyzed to train what they call models, patterns of human behavior.
Behavioral economics was an approach that extended its influence into other domains. If it could be used to change a president, then other tasks like marketing and selling a product were also possible. Marketers showed interest in this approach. They monitored people's behavior, analyzed it, and based on the results, took action to, for example, increase the sales of a product. This approach was a form of surveillance-based market, which transformed the way products were sold.
I can see how people with these characteristics typically behave over time, and that allows me to fit your data right into that arc and to predict what you're likely to do, not only now, but soon and later. This is what I call behavioral surplus. These data streams filled with these rich predictive data. Why surplus? Because right from the start, these were more data than was required to improve products and services.
Surveillance marketing was compared to the methods used by medieval peddlers, who were also known as charlatans. Charlatans were noisy, theatrical individuals whose work involved commotion, flashy performances, and ridiculous speeches. Their dazzling shows would trap people in the town square, keeping them entertained, but their work went beyond mere entertainment. Charlatans manipulated minds to exploit people, sometimes by charging for the show, sometimes by selling useless items, and sometimes through outright theft. Historians consider charlatans the pioneers of a certain trend, a form of indirect influence and communication with individuals. They argue that while the Middle Ages may be over, the age of charlatans is not. The experimental model of these figures has been passed down through generations and absorbed into various professions, including marketing, where the goal is to sell a product. This profession has been implicated not only in the scandal of the 2016 election, but also in other unbelievable disasters, ones that stretch back over a century.
What's really happening is that we provide personal information, but the information that we provide is the least important part of the information that they collect about us.
The beginning of the 20th century marked the onset of major transformations. The Industrial Revolution changed not only lifestyles, but history itself. On one hand, population growth, and on the other, the expansion of urbanization signaled the arrival of a new era, the era of capitalism. Traditional methods of production were abandoned, and mass production took their place. It was now the age of money, the age of profit-driven thinking, and humanity's growing inclination toward consumerism. But a major concern loomed. What would happen to capitalism if consumerism declined? The charlatans of the Middle Ages reappeared, this time dressed as marketers, to answer that question. Marketing became the profession capitalism needed, a job that linked the realm of production to the realm of consumption. In other words, the art of selling. The goal of marketers was to generate more profit for companies. Their work sometimes involved advertising, sometimes boosting production, sometimes focusing on sales, and sometimes altering prices strategies. Of course, some of them had other ideas, unconventional ones aimed at intensifying consumerism.
He said, we're losing half of our market because men have invoked the taboo against women smoking in public. Can you do anything about that? I said, let me think about it. And then I said, have I your permission to see a psychoanalyst to find out what cigarettes mean to women?
March 31st, 1929. It was Easter Sunday, and the streets of New York were packed with people. Everything seemed normal, until photographers noticed a few women walking by. At that time, women smoking in public was considered socially inappropriate, so the image of those women quickly made front page headlines. Newspapers and media outlets portrayed the event as a feminist act of liberation, but the story had a more questionable backstory. Behind the scenes, the American Tobacco Company was involved. In those years, cigarettes were seen as a symbol of masculinity, and most American women had little interest in smoking. So the company set out to turn women into consumers of its products. To achieve this, they hired a seasoned marketer named Edward Bernays. In reality, the event had nothing to do with feminism. Bernays, like the charlatans of the Middle Ages, staged a performance, a spectacle designed to execute his idea amid the public frenzy. He hired those women, paid the photographers, and coordinated the newspaper coverage. It was a full-blown production under the banner of freedom, but it served the interests of American tobacco. The implicit image of the campaign was, if you want to be free, you must smoke. This idea quickly proved effective. Women, half the population of the United States, became regular cigarette consumers, and the company experienced a dramatic surge in sales. Bernays' work was a fusion of marketing and economic psychology, a kind of miracle that opened new paths for his peers. Marketers were destined to be the driving force behind many other historical events.
Today we'll focus on one small element of their problems. We'll focus on the use of a product intended to nourish life, to enable infants to thrive and grow, to see how it can have the unintended effects of fostering malnutrition and spreading disease. We'll focus on the advertising, marketing, and promotion and the use of infant formula in developing nations.
The mid-20th century was the age of great dominion, an era ruled by multinational corporations whose sole aim was expanding consumption and maximizing profit. On the other side of this story stood marketing, a profession that, over several decades, had developed increasingly effective methods for selling goods. Its primary clients were those same large corporations, companies determined to conquer every market, especially in underdeveloped countries. Nestlé was one of these giants, a food industry behemoth that initially set its sights on Africa. Nestlé's marketers employed an aggressive strategy known as dumping, a method where products are introduced into a market either for free or at extremely low prices. On the surface, this tactic seemed economically damaging. But the full story was far more complex. Nestle's marketing campaign began in medical centers. The plan was to win over doctors by offering financial support. Then, Nestle employees dressed as nurses appeared on the scene. Doctors recommended infant formula, and these fake nurses handed out cheap formula packages to pregnant women. Simultaneously, widespread advertising promoted the benefits of formula milk. The result was a surge in popularity for Nestle's product, turning it into a serious competitor to breast milk. African mothers no longer feared their own milk drying up. The prevailing narrative claimed that formula was more nutritious and beneficial than breast milk. Everything seemed fine, until Nestle announced new pricing. Thousands of mothers were left confused and distressed. Now they could neither rely on their own milk nor afford to buy formula regularly. To save money, mothers began diluting the formula with excess water, but that's where the real problem began. The dilution stripped the formula of its nutrients and did little to support infant growth. In many parts of Africa, clean water was scarce. The formula was mixed with contaminated water, creating a new and deadly crisis. Soon, severe malnutrition and food poisoning began to spread. The conditions in medical centers revealed the depth of the catastrophe, a disaster that claimed the lives of thousands of infants. This tragedy was a direct result of dumping, a method of selling products at extremely low prices. Dumping had two main objectives: eliminating competitors from the market and creating consumer dependency. The absence of alternative products and the artificial creation of demand forced people to buy a specific item. Initially, the company incurred losses, but this was only temporary. Once dumping took effect, the product could be sold at any desired price, a price that would compensate for earlier losses and monopolize the entire market. Nestle didn't just take over the African market, it cost human lives, a disaster so grave that even lengthy court proceedings couldn't undo its damage. The Nestle case signaled a deeper crisis looming in the years ahead.
Feeling that's so deep inside. The face. Faith in our hearts will always rise.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Trump is slashing refugee numbers in the U.S. while carving out more slots for white South African farmers. Now, is he protecting America or weaponizing race on the world stage? To discuss Trump's Africana racist agenda, we are joined by Aisha Kaji. Now, she is an international relations and African governance analyst. Also joining us in the conversation is Aaron Ngambi. Now, he is a geopolitical analyst and a contributor to the Mail and Guardian newspaper. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we delve deep into Trump's Africana racist agenda. When Donald Trump slashed refugee admissions to historic lows, he said it was about protecting U.S. interests. Under Obama, the cap was 110,000. Trump cut it to 45,000 in 2018 and later pushed it to bring it down to just 40,000 by 2026. But look closer at those numbers. Of the 40,000 slots, Trump set aside 30,000, that is 75%, for white Africana farmers. That's a group that makes up less than 4% of South Africa's population. Now, this racial favoritism is hard to miss, especially when compared to his travel bans and restrictions on African and Muslim-majority nations. And the strategy went even further. The administration tied outsourcing the refugee process to Kenya, planning to send 30 Kenyan workers to South Africa. Pretoria pushed back, refusing to bend its visa laws for a program that looked less like humanitarian aid and more like a racially charged political project. Trump also pushed the false claim that farm crimes in South Africa amounted to genocide against whites. That's been debunked by South African officials and independent experts. Still, it shows how racism and white supremacy is shaping Trump's refugee policy. So, is this really about saving lives or just weaponizing race and refugee policy for Trump's political theater?
Trump's Africana racist agenda.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has strongly refuted claims that whites or Afrikaners in the country are facing persecution. Let's take a listen.
Those people who are being enticed to go to the United States do not fit the definition of a refugee. A refugee is someone who has to leave their country out of fear of political persecution, religious persecution. They don't fit that bill. They don't fit that description. We were well taught by Nelson Mandela and other iconic leaders like Oliver Tambo on how to continue to build a united nation out of the diverse groupings that we have in South Africa. We're the only country on the continent where the colonizers came to stay, and we have never driven them out of our country. So they are staying, and they are making great progress. It's a fringe grouping that does not have a lot of support, that is anti-transformation and anti-change.
Well, the Trump administration attempted to outsource much of the African refugee process to Kenya, sending workers there rather than managing resettlement directly in the U.S. Now, this unusual arrangement raised questions about efficiency, legality, and intent. Now, let's start off with Aisha Kaji. What does this strategy reveal about the administration's overall approach to humanitarian crisis, and why was Kenya chosen as the processing hub instead of handling it domestically?
Well, the Trump administration itself is in something of a crisis right now, given the so-called efficiency measures taken by the Department of Government Efficiency under Elon Musk during the initial part of this administration earlier in the year. So given that there have been many retrenchments and many people have voluntarily left various state departments in the United States, the actual human resourcing of much of the bureaucratic capability in the U.S. has been impacted. And that's possibly one reason they've tried to outsource this, as you say, to Kenya or to have it done outside the United States. The other reason is probably because really this administration and America in general knows very little about the living conditions in Africa and the standards that need to be met in Africa. So the so-called Africana refugee crisis, which is really something of a myth in South Africa itself, is very misunderstood in the United States.
Now, Trump and his allies often claim that white South African farmers are victims of widespread large-scale killings. Experts and South African officials repeatedly debunked these claims, but the narrative continued to drive policy decisions in Washington. Now, Mr. Ngambi, how did such exaggerated claims shape U.S. foreign policy under Trump, and why were they so misleading, in your opinion?
Now, in order to understand where this is coming from, we have to look at exactly what happened before even Trump took office. You will remember that Donald Trump was heavily supported by the billionaire Elon Musk, who is himself a South African by birth, and other people that were interested in Trump's presidency or Trump coming back for the second term. It seems like these speculations, these misfounded stories, these myths began with that group. Of course, Elon Musk and some of the people who are white South African, they understand how Washington works. They know that Washington is all about lobbying, and basically politicians in the United States are bought out by the lobby group. Therefore, they mounted this campaign to try to smear South Africa, to try to project South Africa in the bad light, simply because Elon Musk, we understand, that had a problem with the South African government and his company Starlink.
The State Department's push to bring Kenyan workers into South Africa to process Afrikaner refugees appeared to blindside Pretoria. Officials there expressed surprise and frustration at being asked to bend visa rules to accommodate the program. This reflects the usual arrogant approach the US government takes in dealing with African governments, and Trump only made it more obvious.
Washington's style of diplomacy with Africa has been problematic, to say the least, given that it has taken a very parochial and patriarchal approach towards African governments, including both South Africa and Kenya. So Washington obviously regards itself as some kind of senior partner in any bilateral or multilateral conversation between the United States and African countries more generally. It's really quite preposterous to then expect that South African bureaucrats, South Africans in working for the state in Pretoria should have to deal with Kenyan counterparts to process applications for refugee status in the United States. It's a really odd situation. It's unprecedented anywhere in the world.
While Trump slashed refugee admissions for people fleeing wars and disasters worldwide, he prioritized white South Africans for special entry. Many observers argued this reflected a deep racial bias in how humanitarian issues were framed.
We see that Trump has demonstrated that he would prefer to give preference to people that are white or people that are of a certain race or class or status, rather than work for the people that are downtrodden or even for the common good. It is true that Trump, he is not favorable when it comes to people who are black or people of a certain color rather than white. And so this is manifest in all the things that he has done. He said a lot of bad things about African countries. He has said a lot of bad things about African leaders. And even today, he has imposed a 30% tariff on South Africa, all the goods that are exported to America from South Africa. All this is a demonstration and evidence that his foreign policy is actually informed by this kind of thinking, which is misguided and is unfortunate.
South Africa's government has pushed back strongly against the Africana Resettlement Initiative, publicly denying reports and expressing irritation at U.S. pressure. Now, the standoff highlighted a widening rift between the two countries. Aisha Kaji, this for you. How damaging was this issue for U.S.-South Africa relations, both diplomatically and politically?
Well, so relationships between South Africa and the U.S. have already been strained. And part of the strain is this myth of a white genocide, an Afrikaner genocide in this country, which has been fed, as I said before, by some of Mr. Trump's advisors. However, when President Ramaphosa visited Washington, D.C. at the White House, and Mr. Trump once again attempted to bring up this narrative of an Afrikaner genocide or a white genocide, he did so pointing to news reports and photographs that were not even from South Africa. He did so pointing to a memorial site in Pretoria, which had nothing to do with the so-called white genocide or genocide of Afrikaners. So the insistence of the Trump administration on this narrative, when it is blatantly untrue, when it has been disproved over and over again, is very frustrating for South Africans and for the South African state, because any attempts to disprove it are just not believed by Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump prefers to believe misinformation and disinformation instead of the truth. And as a result, the relationship between the United States and South Africa, which has been fraught already because of the ICJ case against Israel, at the International Court of Justice, and various other South African stances, particularly on Palestine, and to a lesser extent on Iran, have soured the relationship between this U.S. administration and South Africa. Attempts by South Africa to renegotiate that relationship have been fraught with frustration. And that frustration is largely due to the Trump administration's insistence, as I said, on relying on misinformation and disinformation, even when that misinformation and the myth is debunked for them. They still prefer to believe the lie rather than the truth. And it's very difficult at a diplomatic level to deal with a counterpart.
Well, thanks for that. Let's now take a short break before we continue our conversation on Trump's Africana racist agenda. Stay with us.
Trump's Africana racist agenda.
A leading South African opposition politician, Julius Malema, has criticized U.S. President Trump for promoting the false genocide narrative of mass graves of whites in South Africa. Now, he says that his country is being targeted by Trump for filing a case against the Israeli apartheid regime at the International Court of Justice over its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Let's take a listen.
South Africa has got no place for mass graves of white people, and there's no genocide. But that is not the issue. We all know what the issue is. The issue is Israel. The issue is to push back South Africa on Israel, on Russia. The issue is to impose Starlink without following the necessary empowerment laws of South Africa.
Now, at the same time Trump championed white South Africans, his administration expanded travel bans and voiced open hostility towards African nations. Now, these seemingly contradictory policies baffle diplomats and watchdogs alike. Now, Mr. Ngabi, how do you reconcile Trump's efforts to resettle Afrikaners with his broader hardline stance against African migration?
Yes, that's a very good observation. In fact, what is disheartening is that Trump, in his first term as president of the United States, never set foot on African soil. And I don't think that he's going to go to Africa in his second term of office, even though he was invited to attend the G20 summit in November of this year, which we're yet to see if he'll actually go to South Africa. That's where it will take place. So you can see clearly here that Donald Trump has no interest in Africa whatsoever, unless it comes to rare earth minerals, or it comes to what he can benefit from it. But over and above, his policies towards Africa, the travel bans, and now he has also instituted, his administration has instituted this visa bond on some of the countries. You have to pay about $5,000 to $15,000, including Zambia and Malawi, in order for you to actually get a visitor's visa to go to the United States. All of these are policies that demonstrate that Trump is not about putting Africa first or having cordial relations with Africa, but rather it's about what he can get or benefit from Africa.
Critics in South Africa accuse the Trump administration of meddling in domestic affairs by elevating Afrikaner farmers into a global political issue. For many, it looked less like humanitarian concern and more like U.S. political theater. Now, Ms. Kaji, is this program another example of Trump using diplomacy as a stage for America's internal political wars?
That's actually a really good question. Because Mr. Trump was elected largely by the portion of the electorate that believes in white supremacy, that is strongly right-wing and redneck, if you will, and that therefore would be sympathetic to this narrative of Afrikaner genocide, of white South Africans needing asylum, needing to be refugees in the United States. So yes, it is a piece of theater, political theater. It is a piece of grandstanding, and it does have a ripple effect on the American electorate and on American internal affairs, particularly amongst Trump's voter base, which has shrunk since he was elected.
In the US, far-right groups applauded Trump's focus on white South African farmers, hailing it as proof he was protecting Western civilization. Analysts have rejected claims of persecution of Afrikaners, and therefore they have no justification in seeking refugee status in the US.
Seeking refugee status in the US is quite ludicrous, and this is going to backfire in the long term because the INS in the US does not need an added headache of so-called Afrikaner refugees as part of the immigration process. And we've already seen, as we started out saying, this whole issue of outsourcing the bureaucracy or the administration to Kenyans of all people. So in the long term, in the medium to long term, this is going to cause more problems both at the state level because of the processing demands, and it's going to also cause problems in assimilating those so-called Afrikaner refugees into American society. While they may share the same white supremacist views as much of Mr. Trump's electoral base, they have had a position of relative privilege in South Africa for generations, which they will not find in the US. And you may well find that they are disaffected sooner rather than later. They will not assimilate easily. And even those who do assimilate will place a burden on the U.S. economy because they are used to having, shall we say, blue-collar type work done for them. They're not used to doing it for themselves.
South African officials have said that farm attacks were rooted in broader security issues, not ethnic persecution. Yet, Trump insists on framing them as racially motivated, a narrative more aligned with right-wing media than reality. Mr. Ndambi, you have the last word. Why is Trump so determined to cast these incidents as ethnic persecution despite evidence to the contrary?
Well, the reason why President Trump has been ill-benched to project South Africa as a lunatic state, as a pariah state, as a country that is so absolutely unreasonable, it's because he knows that if he continues pounding on that narrative, then other countries will distance themselves from South Africa. And also, whatever actions America takes against South Africa will be seen almost as acceptable. Like I said, he has imposed 30% trade tariffs on all the goods from South Africa being exported to the United States, and nobody is saying anything. Well, the next thing is that we might see sanctions on South Africa. Why? Because it's looking for an excuse and to project a narrative that would justify that excuse. Now, unfortunately, we have to also say that in all of this, Trump has been on the wrong side of history. And this is why President Ramaphosa of South Africa visited the White House to be able to explain what is happening in South Africa. The government of South Africa is very clear that, of course, there's crime in South Africa, even among white farmers. People are dying on both sides, across the board, black and white, in these farms. But the issue of white genocide does not exist. And if people argue that this is something that exists, they should ask themselves, what about Orania? There's this township in South Africa, which is a white separatist township, completely white, and it's about 3,000.